Welcome to the Athenaeum Review podcast. I'm Ben Lima, and we're very happy to have as our guest today Dr. Nils Roemer, who is the Rabin Professor of Holocaust Studies at UT Dallas, as well as the director of the Ackerman Center for Holocaust Studies. And he is now also the interim dean of the School of Arts and Humanities at UT Dallas. Dr. Roemer, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
If I could just ask you, you've now been the interim dean for a full academic year, and obviously there have been some surprising, unexpected developments during that time. I wondered if you could just give a kind of overview of how far the school has come in that time and what you're looking ahead to at the moment.
You know, I recently joked with Dennis Kratz, the previous dean, about it, and said, well, I really picked a good year to take over this role with the pandemic and everything going on. And so this year, therefore, has been a, you know, fairly, you know, rich in its various challenges. I think initially taking over the role of interim dean, it's a big job. Requires a lot of learning, and I think I spent a lot of time just getting to know, you know, everything in the first couple of months, getting to, you know, to organize the faculty, thinking about faculty, engaging the faculty with new ideas and initiatives. And then while that was still on their way, then all of a sudden the pandemic started to hit, and so we had to shift midway. And I think that was more or less the second half, where really within a 2-week span, we had to convert all of our classes into the online format and all that, which is, you know, it entailed. So lots of ways, the second half was really dense. And I'm now, for the first time, I'm looking at my weekly calendar feeling, ooh, there's room to think again.
Yeah.
And I think we, you know, this is important also thinking forward. We need time to think and not just simply to deal with this immediacy of this crisis and, you know, how we do this and how do we do that, but also really think about it again in terms of where we want to be. And I think that's more than ever now the case, where I think many things that, you know, have been already, you know, something that we would have debated, the place of the humanities in the 21st century and the arts respectively, I think all of that focus has been, if anything, sharpened now by the pandemic. I mean, just in simple terms, the very core of what we do in the humanities is about engagement. It's about closeness. It's about proximity. It's about the classroom, the ensemble, the studio. It's all the things that are diametrically on the other side of the scale from what we call social distancing now.
Yeah.
And so that's a big challenge of sorts. How to think about ourselves in that span, and not just to think about ourselves just in terms of having lost all of that, but also having maybe learned something new. And I think we all kind of realized that online teaching might have been a little foreign to us at first.
Yeah.
But I think many of our faculty would agree with me that it wasn't quite like they would have expected, that in many ways, once they started doing it, they realized that it was a little different from what they might have thought, and that in many ways, while we would have called our online teaching, let's say, remote teaching, mm-hmm. it didn't always mean that we were remote from our students, but in many ways, this online teaching, I was surprised, you know, how engaging students were, that they, you know, lingered on after class, that they still wanted to ask questions through the chat channel and questions, you know, that they post, you know, by unmuting themselves. So I think there's a lot for us to also take in and rethink a little bit in terms of what that means for us, the arts and humanities.
I know that, I mean, while we're all in the midst of this thing, at least for me, or probably for many people, it's easy to have a little bit of, let's say, tunnel vision and think only about kind of this moment. But hopefully, or we can hope that eventually this will pass and, you know, we hope a vaccine and so on and so forth, and there will be some kind of back to normal. But I wanted to ask you, looking ahead kind of past that time, among the kind of changes that have happened during this spring, are there aspects of this that you expect would continue even after it's back to normal? I mean, for instance, would we expect to have more online interaction or online teaching kind of permanently, or things that.
So, that's like thinking a little bit ahead. So for starters, I think we all were in a crash course, right?
Yeah.
If I would have asked in February how many of us are using Teams, that would have been a very small percentage point. Now we're almost at 100%. So this has been, we are in a sharp learning curve about technology. And I think for starters, within a big school that is internally as diverse as we are, this provides a great opportunity for us to stay internally more connected with each other and to work together. On different types of things, then yes, it does create opportunities for us. This summer is a great example. This summer, we're teaching only online classes.
We
are, so to speak, in the middle of the crisis, but we are generating far more credit hours this summer than we ever have. This is the best of all possible summers that we've ever produced, which, if you think about how important is enrollment is really critical. So judging by that right now, we're doing really, really well.
Yeah.
But I think one critical, aspect of what we do is that we have to recognize always, I think, respectively, what is the place of the humanities and the arts on a campus or in our society. And I think the technology and the way we've been using it now has maybe convinced us a bit more that there is no need for borders, that in many ways we can connect and we can also globally connect as far better than we might have done. I mean, historically, we've connected ourselves by going to conferences, by sending over emails, but I can see now very easily how in the one or the other subject matters, we can have these kind of quote unquote temporarily globally connected classrooms where we can bring in people from elsewhere who are part of a short kind of conversation about whatever aspects we are studying. And so I think that's a great opportunity, in particular since that global orientation is very much part of our campus culture. Mm-hmm. We are one of the most diverse campuses that you can think of. We have students from over 100 different countries. Why not use this as a way to connect with them also in other ways?
And also to
connect us with across campus. I think the model that we've now have at is that we have these schools, and I think the schools have become a little bit too much self-enclosed in my taste. Mm-hmm. And I think in particular we have become too self-enclosed, and I think we have to come to this more with the aspirations that the humanities and the arts are relevant to no matter what, and that there is no limit to our relevance. And I think technology might be one way how we can manifest that and demonstrate that presence in whatever conversations one may or may not want to have right now.
That's very, very inspiring to be sure. I noticed one of the things that was, I thought, very encouraging this spring was that not just one, but actually there are several new full-time tenure track faculty members who were hired, in spite of all of the COVID and so forth. I thought this is really a sign of forward momentum and strength and commitment.
Well, I think we are generally, yes. So we were ecstatic that we succeeded in completing our four surges. We were worried toward the end that we would, hit a wall at some point with a hiring freeze, but luckily we were able to complete four searches. At the same time, we also are looking at the number of retirements. So I think all in all, the university, and then I think again, the school is very much in a moment also of transition, of change, of looking toward new opportunities. We have faculty that is retiring. We have faculty that we've just recently hired. We are now becoming an exceedingly young faculty, so much so that we have barely any full professors left. I mean, we are like, if you think about our pyramid, we are a fairly young bunch all of a sudden. Our Dennis stepped down just last year. I took over. So there's a lot of change right now all around the school. And I think with that comes also, you're the student of Germany and of the Weimar Republic, crisis or change is also always an opportunity. And I think that's very much the sense that I have right now, that this kind of transition that we're experiencing anyway, and then put together with the pandemic, is really an opportunity for us as well.
There was something you you mentioned a moment ago about the relations between arts and humanities and the other schools or the other parts of UT Dallas. I wanted to follow up and just ask if, kind of looking forward, there were particular kind of connections that you were hopeful about between arts and humanities and the broader, I mean, UT Dallas is obviously very big. There's many different schools. So are there certain places that you think have good chances for kind of increasing those connections?
Well, this is an interesting one. You know, again, I was trained as a historian who had minor fields in literature and philosophy. So the model of knowledge that I absorbed was a very compartmentalized one. You know, this is where you did this, and this is what you where you did this. And I think if nowadays, if we don't think, for starters, from our perspective, don't want to collaborate with EBS or with ATEC, but if you think about, you know, what do our students actually do, then I think we have a lot of catching up to do. Why is it that we have so many students from outside of our school that are in our music performance, in our theater, in our creative writing courses? I think they're pursuing a very different model of knowledge than the one that I initially, you know, came to embrace, where my mind, so to speak, you know, I mean, you know what I'm talking about, was disciplined, in my case, to think historically.
Yeah.
And then I think we had some other version in between that we've been pursuing, where we wanted to look for kind of abilities to connect knowledge across these disciplines to become interdisciplinary. Yeah. But I think I'm not quite sure that that's what our students are looking for. They're looking, again, for some kind of a diversity of experience of knowledge, where they're looking for some models of making these compatible with each other. And I think that's maybe where our connections come in, and where we can think about finding ourselves some, so to speak, new friends and collaborating with people outside of our school. And that can be in technology. That can be with our, you know, cultural, you know, expertise with the School of Management. It can be in any shape or form. I don't think it has any limits. I think it would be interesting, we can't do this, but it would be interesting if we were to plot out, you know, in a spatial manner where our students come from that, you know, have just been in the, let's say, in the, our last Rocky Horror Picture Show or in our creative writing course. I think it would be a very scattered image that you get. I don't think that they would all kind of come out of the computer science or all of the School of Management. I think they would come from across. And I think that's where I think we want to go back to. I think these moments where knowledge is produced out of, you know, coincidental discoveries and the pursuit of curiosity. I mean, you and I, we talked earlier a little bit about the Athenaeum and about the idea of spaces of knowledge.
Yeah.
And so I have two spaces that I always like to think about, coffee houses.
Yeah.
That, you know, were defined by the relative openness that attracted people from across a wider social strata, but also from different fields of expertise. And therefore you could have the physicians sit right next to the creative writer, and that created in a particular moment this outburst of creative energy in Vienna.
Yeah.
And that's the coffee houses. And then you can think about my other big passion is the city. And you know, the traditional view of the flaneur, the stroller, is the one who doesn't follow a map, by one who aimlessly strolls around and thereby makes discoveries. And I think it's that kind of sense of curiosity that we might have to regain a little bit in order to, and then find our friends and our partners, instead of going at it with a clearly charted path that we are trying to create, like highways now of knowledge between us and, let's say, ATEC, the Arts and Technology Program, or us and EBS or something like that. Maybe let's get away from the highways and let's get to down to the streets and do rather the individual curiosity and the exploring and see where that takes us. Because I think that's what our students are doing.
That's I like this excellent urban metaphor. I think perfect. Well, finally, I've been asking you in your role as dean, but I wanted to be sure also in your role as director of the Ackerman Center. I know that that center has made a very quick and very impressive transition to digital just this spring with a number of events and so forth. I know that the staff has been working very hard on that. Looking ahead for the Ackerman Center, are there certain initiatives for this upcoming year that you want to mention or that you're looking forward to especially?
So again, the Ackerman Center, like the school, is in a moment of change. So I am the director of the Ackerman Center, but I'm currently teaching far less. At the same time, our long-term, Juji, the founding director, she's retiring. So that's, a big change. At the same time, we're bringing on a new faculty member, Amy Kerner. So there's a lot of change. But one thing that I had already felt very clearly earlier, but now I'm really committed to it, is I think we want to create an online MA in Holocaust and Human Rights Education. I think there's enough of a market out there. There are a couple of other places that offer Holocaust and Genocide Education. I think we want to make Holocaust and Human Rights our connection. And I think there's enough interest. And then the Ackerman Center at this point is big enough that I think has the right name recognition and has the facilities and that it can pull this off. So this is my big goal for the upcoming year, to have us work on this as our big new initiative. Most other events, we're still in a kind of wait and see position because we're still not entirely sure, is it going to be a face-to-face or is it going to be a virtual event? And so that's, what's holding us back there a little bit. But in terms of our ability to plan, that we don't quite yet know what it is that we're lining ourselves up for.
Well, that's certainly very exciting about this MA. I would imagine that there's a great deal of demand interest among students for that.
Very much. And otherwise, on any of my other art days that I try to find, in particular now with the summer, I'm trying to finish at least one book, if not two. So fingers crossed, maybe I can finally do something there as well.
Will you tell us just briefly about what those books are?
Well, one is, indirectly I mentioned it, it's I've had this long-term interest, and I've published already articles on this, on travel literature, and in particular traveling in urban spaces. It's something that I personally have always enjoyed, discovering new cities, and therefore I guess it has become part of my scholarly interest. And so I have a manuscript actually ready now that tracks Central European Jewish travel writing from the 1880s into the immediate post-war period. So hopefully I can send that one off and be done with it. But that's where my passion about the flaneur and all of this comes from. That invariably you talk to me, I was going to find some way of tying it into the flaneur, because I think it's a really curious figure with all of its problems. It's a male figure. It provides a very privileged gaze. Therefore, I'm interested in this insofar as the travelers that I'm looking at, their own identity is shaped both by their class and their nationality, but also by their ethnicities, being Jewish. And therefore, they're not always central. They're sometimes, they're gay, sometimes it's privileged and sometimes less privileged.
Yeah.
And then the other one is really tied to the Holocaust. And so I'm really been lecturing left and right about this, and now is really the time to hopefully get this done. And I have what my youngest son would call a sloppy draft of that one together. So that's is built around something which, is in lots of ways very basic for historians, but I don't think it has been really done as much for the Holocaust, and that is to think about the Holocaust as something that continuously evolves in the period after 41. So instead of it being masterminded and blueprinted and then executed, it's actually something that becomes far more dynamic and takes on different forms as the war changes. And so I think, we have to remember that the decision to a genocide was made while Germany was still largely on the height of their power, while they continue to execute their genocides all the way toward the end when they were at the lowest end of their power. Mm-hmm. So I think this has got to be considered as something that is a fundamental difference, whether you, you know, carry out genocide in the midst of victories or in the midst of defeats. And I think it changes the ideology. And I think that's something that hasn't been seen as much.
Yeah. Well, perhaps in the future we could do another podcast conversation about one or the other of these books when the time comes.
Absolutely. I would love that. Thank you very much, Ben. This has been a real pleasure talking to you.
Thank you very much for coming on the podcast. Our guest today was Dr. Niels Roemer, who's the Interim Dean of Arts and Humanities at UT Dallas. And this is the Athenaeum Review Podcast.